Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine this, you're stranded on an island, forever. But don't freak out because you get to bring one dish with you, your desert island dish. What is it?
Every week your hosts, Paul and Tegan, that's us.
Hello.
Will ask this question. They'll chat with and torment a literal raft of guests on the island who'll dish up stories, gossip and culinary secrets.
But they all have one big thing in common, they bloody love food.
Welcome to Dish Island.
Hello and welcome to another episode. I'm Tegan Higginbotham.
I'm Paul Verhoeven.
And Paul, have you cooked anything interesting this week? Maybe tried something new?
That's a really nice setup because the fact is you're the only person I cook for anymore. Right? So I'll cook things and then you pretty much just have to eat them. But I saw one of the chefs over at Bon Appetit was doing this Instagram story and I was just like spooling through. I didn't think anything of it. And I had that thing where it grabbed my imagination. Mm-hmm. And hours later, I gone off and bought the ingredients and I cooked up this pasta and it was so good. I think I've made it four times since then.
We've eaten a lot of it, but it is brilliant. And all it's one of those really great pastas where you can tweak little things, talk people through it.
Okay. So basically the pasta that you use is a Strozzabret, which is those two little kind of curls. And I know that I sounded like Mario from the Mario Brothers just then, but that's okay.
It's all right. Just lean in.
Yeah. So it's you fry up some capers and some garlic and some diced artichoke hearts from the jar. And you kind of, you put those in the pan with some oil. And then you pop in some cherry tomatoes and sort of blacken those a little bit and then squish them. And then he says that you got to just throw through some random seafood.
Yep.
So I went with mussels and, you know, I chucked in some squid at one point and we kind of rolled that around and then you throw in the pasta and then you piff in heaps of fresh dill and like you squeeze in a whole lemon and it was like being in the Mediterranean. It was incredible.
And as the weather warms up here in Melbourne, it just felt like such a summery, light, welcome to warmth sort of dish. It was amazing.
Yeah.
But speaking of first, Paul, this is a momentous episode for two reasons. Mm. To our lovely listeners, you probably noticed something a little bit different at the beginning of the episode or on our podcast artwork, which is that we are now going by the name Dish Island.
Yeah, it's a bit of a rebrand. Here's the thing. You know, in the first episode, how we sort of floated the fact that, you know, the desert island dish as a concept had already been established. It's already out there.
It was
right?
A shock to us, but we went with it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we got a little panicky. I mean, we're not going to lie. But that's okay because branding is very important.
So we realized that the desert island dish theme, not entirely original. Mm-hmm. Then we've also discovered that it turns out every second podcast in existence uses the word dish.
Or is called dish in some way. So obviously we've decided to, just do a slight rebrand.
And half of you thought that the show was called Dish Island anyway. The Instagram account is
Dish Island.
Dish Island.
Oh my
and
God.
We invite people to our Dish Island. So you know what? It makes sense. We are now Dish Island. And Paul, I'm feeling really bloody excited about this.
It's the best rebrand since the Terminator was changed to the Terminator from Angry Robot Man. It's like, just call it Terminator. It makes so much more sense.
But there's another big first this week, Paul. Mm. Everyone who listened last week will know that we have a very special guest on today. However, he's done something wild. He has chosen the same desert island dish as one of our previous
guests. Yes.
And now he didn't realize that he was doing this, okay? He hadn't listened to the episode in question, didn't realize that this dish was already on our table in the big, long feasting hall on our island.
Hang on, we don't have a feasting hall.
We do now. There's a feasting hall.
Look, I'm just stunned that you're adding bits of architecture to this island without my permission. I mean, I thought we had some sort of quorum going here, like we all agreed on things.
It's a day of first. Okay, Paul, and now there is a feasting hall. We're going to have a double up dish for the very first time ever. I'm excited.
Well, let me introduce our guest. Today's guest is a TV presenter, an author, and a superb cook. You'll have seen him hosting The Cook Up with Adam Liao on SBS. Damn, his name's...
Who could it be?
Surprise, surprise, it's Heston Blumenthal. Or you've seen him winning season two of MasterChef. He's turned out so many incredible best-selling cookbooks, and he's got several new amazing shows cooking up right now, The Bloody Show Off. So please welcome Adam Liao.
Thanks for joining us. I'm sorry to pull you away from your very busy, busy life because you had a lot on the horizon until we kidnapped you. You just announced a new television show. Congratulations.
I did. Thank you very much.
This is going to be starting soon on Channel 9.
Good Food Kitchen is what it's called. And actually, it's something that I have to kind of be a bit sheepish about. I'm announcing another television show today as well. I'm not in charge of these announcements. These are shows that I made in the past that are now all just all of a sudden being announced altogether. So there's one called Adam and Poe's Malaysia in Australia that I'm doing with Poe Ling Yeo for SBS and Asia Food Network in Singapore. And that is being announced today. And Good Food Kitchen that I'm doing for Nine was announced yesterday.
Do you not have enough going on?
I mean, we were already, our whole angle was going to be like, wow, you're the busiest man in food in Australia. You really are. Holy shit.
Yeah, at the moment, there's a fair bit on.
When you're in a kitchen, obviously you're multitasking, you know, you've got like 15 things on different burners. Is that what you're doing with your life right now?
Sometimes. You know, I guess I'm a TV cook kind of guy, so I'm not by the stove every single day when I'm not filming. So the other show I do, the third one, the cook-up that I do for SBS, we start filming that again in a couple of weeks, and so then I will be on the burners every day, filming that one. But there's a lot of pre-production and recipe development and things that happen, and you know, most of my cooking is I just cook for my family, so that's the way I like it, to be honest.
Right, but you sound very organized. I mean, because when I cook, it's a garbage fire. There's just stuff everywhere. There's no rhyme or reason.
You blow up the kitchen every time.
I literally have to walk up to Tig and go, I'm sorry, I exploded the kitchen again. Whereas, are you the kind of person who psychologically has like 15 ramekins with different ingredients portioned out? Or do you just kind of approach every day, one day at a time?
It's not clinical, the way I cook, so I'm not very much a ramekin portioner. But I do think that you can kind of tell, and I don't mean this as a slight Paul, how capable someone is in the kitchen by how clean it is while they're doing it. You know, if I get like, and I'm not saying that I'm immune to this. If I get a bit out of control, the kitchen looks out of control. But if I'm in control, the kitchen is always clean. And I always remember, you know, my grandma, cooking, and there was no point. Like, she could turn out literally 30 dishes a day. And there would be, the kitchen would be clean the entire time, from like prep to cooking to cleaning to finishing up. There was no point where the kitchen was dirty.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that's kind of a, sometimes I worry that people who are messy, it's a kind of psychological selfishness. They want to do the fun part, but they don't want to do the unpleasant stuff, which is the cleaning. It's not, you know, you don't get to eat the cleaning at the end. It's not the fun part. It's not the showy part. Do you think maybe it comes down to having a psychological mindset of being a bit, you know, like a bit of a team player, someone that doesn't want to create chaos down the road for other people?
I think it comes down to a modern malaise of cooking where we kind of have misunderstood what cooking is. Like, cooking is cleaning, you know. Right. Most of cooking is cleaning. Most of cooking is chopping. Yet we seem to think that cooking is putting stuff into a pan. To me, that's the smallest part of actually cooking, is the applying heat to it. But it's the prep and the cooking. It used to be this all-encompassing skill that people had, and now we've decided that, you know, you're right. You know, we only want that tiny little part of it. When it, you know, a generation or two before us, they understood that cooking was gardening, and cooking was curing meats, and cooking was brewing your own soy sauce or whatever it happens to be. And it was this I guess, holistic skill of providing, and we've decided it's dinner parties.
That is so interesting. And I'm thinking of a band, right, where you've got different instruments. Everyone wants to be the guitar soloist. They want to be up the front, just like on their knees with the crowd bang. But actually, you need a drummer, right? You need a roadie. You need a publicist. You need all these other people. And you photograph your own food. So you've kind of added this extra step to that process. Like, what's that like?
I avoided that for ages. You know, I think I'm by nature fairly contrarian. And so when, you know, I didn't have a smartphone until quite recently. By quite recently, I mean 10, 11 years ago. So right. I'm not a total Luddite. But back when, you know, I used to live in Japan, and the phone technology there that they basically had about 15 years ago what we have today. You know, I remember the first time I was walking along with a friend and he was doing what Google Maps does for us now. And you just, you know, walk along and you go, oh, we've got to turn right here to go to the restaurant kind of thing. And I remember seeing that this was, you know, before the days of the iPhone, before smartphones, and he had it on his little flip phone, and it was following us as we were walking down the street. I was like, what is this magic? You know, it's so normal now that it sounds weird for it to be weird, but I was absolutely blown away. This was, you know, my phone could text, and that was pretty much it. You know, in Japan, you don't text because not a thing, but you do send emails from your phone. And I remember being blown away that you could send emails from your phone at that point. And then this guy's pulling out the Google Maps 5 years before Google Maps was a thing.
On that, because, you know, Paul was talking about photographing your food and you said that you'd resisted that for a long time.
Oh, yes. So she's just bringing me back to the point as I went up on the tangent. So I do appreciate that. So the point of that story was that I was a late adopter to that, not because I'm a late adopter to technology, but I am a fairly early adopter, but I just don't like doing what everyone else is doing. So when Instagram and things started and people were photographing their food, I was like, you know, this is my gig. You know, I do food as a gig. I don't need to photograph my own food because I guess, you know, I write cookbooks and the photographer does that. I like the professionals to do it. But then I started to do it and I really enjoyed it. And now I do it just to enjoy it. And I lie in bed and I look at photographs of food that I've eaten in the past. I'm like, oh, that was a good meal.
Yeah, man.
Because we're struggling because, you know, we've started up this podcast and naturally that goes hand in hand with, you know, to get it out there, you've got to have a really nice Instagram and all that sort of stuff. And it's about food, so we should probably photograph our damn food. And I think it's been the most tricky aspect because as soon as we've cooked something that is beautiful and fresh, we just want to eat it. And the idea of then us trying to figure out the lighting and you know, spin the bowl that way and, no, sprinkle the thing on that way so it looks fancier, it's one of the elements I'm really struggling with because it also seems to me to be slightly counterintuitive to what I'm trying to do, which is I use cooking now as this way to disconnect from that internet social media space, and it's about, you know, nourishing myself and then to put that spin on it again, that guise of will people like the photograph of the actually one of my best photographed pieces of food yet was your marmalade custard cake.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, which I don't know if I did very well, but it looked very nice in the photograph. But I'm struggling with this aspect. So seeing every night you're plating up these dishes and making them look so fantastic. It is very inspiring to see that.
Thank you. But if I can offer you some advice in that regard, it's find a spot where the lighting is good and just keep putting it in that spot. Like I literally have an old antique French cutting board that I have sitting by a window in the room that's next to my kitchen. And as soon as I cook a dish, I take it, like the camera's already set up there, take it in, plonk it on the cutting board, press the button on the camera, take it in. You know, it is a 90-second process photographing my food, only because I know that at the time of day that we have dinner, which does vary the time doesn't vary, but the light varies from winter to summer, obviously, at that time of day. I kind of just have the same setup so that I don't have to think about it all that much. And in terms of making the food look good for camera, it's just make it look how you want to eat it, which is what you're going to do anyway when you're making dinner, and then just photograph it like that. I think when food looks how you want it to be when you eat it, that's when it looks best in a photo.
I find it so funny that on the iPhone, every year it will assemble, without my consent, Adam, it will assemble this sort of montage to cloying music, like my most precious memories of the year. I like the idea that you're just going to get this like beautiful music video of just meals that you ate throughout the year. I mean, it's so
actually
romantic.
Quite nice. It's a nice thing when that pops up and you go, oh, what did I eat in August 2021?
That's so jaunty. I mean, I'm just thinking about these these things that you're doing, right? Because you are churning out so many recipes and so many meals, not just for your family, but for, you know, TV, print, online. You've got like 900 cooking shows at this point. I mean, how do you keep this interesting for yourself? I mean, this sounds like a in the bedroom metaphor, but how do you keep things how do you keep things exciting and spontaneous?
Role play?
Yeah. I don't know. A strap on whisk, you know.
It reminds me of, so I was teaching my son to skateboard on the weekend, right, and I hurt myself, so that wasn't great. But the way I explained it to him is, because he's very analytical, he likes to, you know, he'll sit at the skate park and watch guys doing everything and try, and you can see him trying to kind of work out theoretically how to do it before he gets onto it. Mm. And what I said to him was, you know, think of this as a puzzle, but for your body. Like, you're not going to work out the puzzle of skateboarding with your mind. You got to work it out with your body. You know, you got to know when you feel like you're going to fall on a drop in, that's a good feeling. You know, when you're walking along and you feel like you're going to fall over, that's a bad thing. But if you're dropping into a quarter pipe or something, then you do need to feel like you're going to fall, because then your balance is going to be in the right spot. So when it comes to cooking, I kind of see that as a puzzle as well, you know, and that's what keeps it interesting for me, is I don't go, oh, let's make something interesting or let's make something tasty. So that's kind of how I approach cooking, is I look at it as a puzzle, and rather than trying to make something that's tasty, I mean, obviously it needs to be tasty, but that's kind of the baseline of where you want to go when you're writing a recipe. I'll try and solve a problem with it. So I guess, you know, if I want a meal that's going to be just from the pantry, or a meal that's going to be something that only uses one pan, or something that you can create in modules so that if somebody likes it spicy, you can have part of it that's spicy and part of it that's not, you know, it's there's always these different ways to cut up something as simple as food, you know. It's like, I guess similar to playing guitar or skateboarding or anything really. Mm. There's always, the deeper you get into it, the more interesting it is, and the more angles that you can see in it. I always remember this thing from year 10 physics. And it was this, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, the teacher's hung over, so they just put a video on and they let you watch it. But it was probably one of the most interesting videos. And he was this American physics teacher. And I don't remember what else he was talking about, because I wasn't very good at physics.
Sure.
But he was explaining why people should care about physics. Because obviously it's not everyone's favorite subject. And he just said, imagine you're walking through a garden, and you're seeing, oh, that's a nice flower, or that's a, you know, that's an interesting tree, or look how big that tree is. Imagine then you're walking through a garden as a botanist, and you're like, oh, wow, I've never seen that species of plant next to that one, or I can see why they planted those two together, or I can see that flower that only blooms for 3 days every 5 years or something. You know, the more you know about it, the more interesting it becomes. And so you can find this interest in it in many different ways as you go along. And that's how I kind of feel with cooking, because I guess my style of cooking is very different to one of a chef, where a chef might come up with a dish for a menu and then they cook that dish every day for a month or a year or forever, you know, depending on the type of restaurant it is. I'm doing new things every single day, and that's kind of what I like about what I do, because I haven't quite worked it out that I think I write more recipes than anyone else in the country. Mm. I'm fairly sure. I can't think of anyone else who's writing sort of 800 recipes a year. But that's what I like about it. Like, I don't, if I was writing 5 recipes a year, I don't think I'd enjoy what I do.
It's funny that you talk about, though, that approach you have, because one of the things I love about the Cook Up is that you skew this line between being both the most informed person in the room and also the person who is just consistently learning and utterly delighted by everything that your guests are bringing in. And it's a fascinating role that you've carved out, that you are able to wear both those hats. You're able to be in that space, both the student and the teacher. And it, as a viewer, it's so comforting, because I think that, you know, no matter where you're at in your food journey, you know, for Paul and I, we feel like we're such novices. We're right at the beginning. So being able to see somebody who's still learning, but also knows so much, it does encourage you to keep going. Do you find that you are, yeah, consistently overwhelmed by how much there is still to learn? Do you feel like you're getting closer to a point where you
know everything?
Adam knows everything.
Am I reaching enlightenment or omnipotence?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, ask me about Afghan cuisine, or ask me about, you know, what's on a family dinner table in Uzbekistan or Ecuador. You know, there is so much to food all around the world, because food is so connected with culture and geography and history and every other aspect of the human condition. Kind of ends up reflected in your food. You know, what's on my dinner table each night is very different from what's on my neighbor's dinner table each night, even though we live in the same neighborhood, we have a similar heritage, we do similar things. And, you know, the thing I like about the cook-up is, for most of my career, it's been very much solitary in terms of what I cook. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if I'm traveling around Japan, I'm the only one that's cooking. You know, there's no one else on the show that's doing a heck of a lot of cooking other than, you know, the restaurants that I go to and things like that. But for the cook-up, every single episode, I get two really interesting chefs or comedians or whoever. I get to look at what other people are actually cooking, and it's a truly fascinating thing. So I don't think it's put on. I think it's pretty genuine, because I am quite amazed at what people cook and how they do it, because it's always different.
I think it's really interesting in that you said you come up with, yeah, like 800 recipes a year. When people go to invent things, there's generally two approaches. They can either look at a need that needs to be filled and then they create a thing to, you know, accompany that need, or they take a thing that already exists and put a clock in it. So when you come up with a recipe, how often are you coming up with something that is wildly new? And how often are you taking something that exists and putting a figurative clock in it?
I would say never coming up with something that is new. You know, frankly, that would be too much work. there is nothing new in cooking. There are things that kind of surprise me at times, and things that I kind of... Well, I will say that one thing that there is in cooking is kind of a lack of innovation, because we do something one way because our mum did it, or our dad did it that way, or our grandma did it that way. Mm. And then we just keep doing it that way because we don't want to think about it. So I guess in some cases I do come up with something new because I think, you know, this is how it's always been done to make this, but get this particular result. But what if we just did it a completely different way? What if we just stopped being snobs about it and tried to really get the shortest line between points A and B. But yeah, sometimes I also just whack a clock in it.
I find that so interesting that you are acknowledging that there's no new things. I mean, does that not...
Well, it's the same in stories. I mean, what do they say? There's only 7 stories that we're just retelling, yeah, the same stories again and again and again.
Yeah.
I guess what I wonder then is, in rehashing these recipes, in putting this new life on recipes, is it culturally important that we do this, that we keep handing these stories, these recipes down from generation to generation, and we keep these things alive? Or is it that we are all just hungry for new things? Consumerism, we want the new book, the new thing, the new contraption to sit in our kitchen, and it is just part of that. Because I like to think that it's the former. I think that this storytelling through recipes is vital.
I think so too, you know, and I guess part of the reason that people think what I do is more innovative than it is that I guess I have a personal history that is probably very different to other people. So I do sit between a lot of different cultures. And when you do, when you're in that position, you can see things that are similar between the two. And I'm not just talking about, you know, putting soy sauce into a burnt butter or something like that, but you can see these different cultural ways that particular issues in domestic cookery are solved. And then you go, well, what if you tried that in a different way? You know, like putting Vegemite into spag bol, for example. You know, just because we have a source of umami in Australia that is common in everyone's kitchen, it's doing the same thing as someone in Japan putting soy sauce or a Western Japanese fish sauce into a stew, for example. It's exactly the same, I guess, taste process as adding Vegemite to your spag bol. And so, you know, you could call that an innovation, but it is kind of the same thing dressed up slightly differently. And so because I feel like I know a number of different cuisines relatively well, you can see those similarities a lot more easily, but I'm not saying that I invented any of them, you know.
So would they have to basically invent, not invent, or discover a new food or a new animal? Like, let's say someone in a lab went, oh, my God, it's a completely new animal. Because
You know, they did that. They did that with that new chocolate.
Ruby chocolate.
And you know what everybody did? They just stuck it on choc chip cookies. And they did the same thing with
but
it.
But they didn't go weird and go, like, all right, we're going to braise it with some owl meat and just go hard into a weird field. Like, do you ever get desperate to just kind of just pivot really hard and get people's attention? Do you ever just consider doing something really weird?
Yeah, I do. But I don't have a TikTok, so I don't have an excuse to do the word. I literally, sometimes I come up with a very weird thing to do, and I go, I wouldn't write this in a recipe that's going to go in a national newspaper. I probably wouldn't do this on my show. I wouldn't do it in a YouTube video, and I wouldn't publish it in a cookbook. But if I had a TikTok, I'd do it on that. So I'm actually going to start a TikTok, I think. Not that I'm like Danny Glover, I'm getting too old for this shit, but I am going to start a TikTok just so I can scratch that itch for something that's weird.
It's just you with a box cutter and an owl just going three easy steps. I'm going to ruin food for you.
It could be as simple as, dipping McDonald's nuggets into KFC sweet and sour sauce, you know?
I don't know if that's allowed in this country.
No, I think they cancel each other out. I think I think the laws of physics have a patent pending thing, and they will actually disappear if you try and cross the streams. But I mean, I do find it very interesting that you are so online, Adam, in a really good way. I think you've really engaged with people online.
There's no such thing as being online in a good way.
I mean, tell me about that. Okay, you groan, but at the same time, I mean, there's BuzzFeed lists of your best tweets. Is that weird being kind of known for one thing and then accidentally or maybe even on purpose straying into another field like that?
One of the best things about social media for people that are in the public eye is that you have greater control over yourself. You know, you don't have to be what the TV network wants you to be or thinks that you are or wants to pigeonhole you as.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You can be whatever you want. You can be yourself. And I'm going to get this wrong because I'm not a theologian, but in a discussion that I had a while back, nor am I Jewish, by the way, in a discussion I had a while back with a rabbi, he was talking about how in the Jewish faith, a person or a truth has, I think the number was 37, could be 36. 36 sounds like a more, I guess, biblical kind of number, Talmudical. I don't know how you would describe it as. But there's 36 aspects to, I guess, a thing. And so if you are just looking at one side of it, you're missing 35 other sides. And to me, that was such an interesting thing because we kind of look at the world as a binary. You know, you're either with us or against us, or you're either LNP or Labour, or, you know, there's all right or wrong, essentially. But the idea that you could have 36 rights that are not, none of them are wrong, they're all just different sides of the same thing, is something that really resonates with me in so many different aspects. You know, when we went into the first lockdown, my kids were, like most kids in lockdown, going absolutely bananas.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I realized, like, okay, these kids have, just to repeat the same number, 36 different personalities in the same way that I have 36 different personalities. You know, I talk to my wife differently to how I talk to my mum, and I talk to my friends differently to how I talk to my kids. You know, none of them are not me, but they're different aspects of me. And so what I realized with my kids was that at school, they're the boss, or they're the funny kid, or they're the smart kid, or whatever they happen to be. But at home, they're just one side of their personality. It's just the kid, and they're the youngest in the house. And so I realized that through that, what they were missing is probably some independence and some ability to show the different social sides of themselves. And so we did, some parents might think it's a bit odd, but we just gave them a lot more freedom to do what they wanted to do. So I do have quite young kids, so they're 8 and 5, but we'd give them a mobile phone and go explore the neighborhood, and they'd wander around, they'd go to another park, and, you know, they'll see a lot of kids from school at the park, and having that ability to define themselves how they wanted to do it was, you know, it was like flicking a switch. They were immediately much better behaved. They were much better rounded. And once again, to come back to the point that we were trying to make, sorry about this.
No, that's fine.
I'm going to do this a lot.
It's great.
It's good.
But for me, I think with being extremely online, it does allow you to sort of indulge the different compartments of yourself that you have. So you can be, you can be more artistic on Instagram. You can try and be funny on Twitter, or whatever it happens to be. I think people contain multitudes, and very rarely in the past did they have the opportunity to actually indulge those.
But people contain multitudes, and I completely agree. But I think would you agree that it's possible for you to contain multitudes and feel good about expressing them and have, you know, sometimes conflicting viewpoints, and you know, people are nuanced. The internet sometimes views people, like you said, in a very binary sense. So how does that kind of mesh? Like, how different is your online persona, i.e., you know, the real you, to your persona on, say, a cooking show?
It's one of the 36, let's just say. You know, but people have their moments. Sometimes they feel like being funny. Sometimes they want to be a shitposter. You know, whatever they happen to be doing. Like, I don't think I'm being disingenuous on any of those different mediums that I engage in. You know, the things that I post on Instagram are not things that are not my dinner. Like, when I say something to my dinner, it's actually what I'm having for dinner. Mm. I try to be as, I guess, honest as possible in every single interaction that I have, whether it is on a TV show or, you know, there are so many different aspects of this. Like, I won't write a recipe the same way for a show like The Cook Up than I would for a show like Destination Flavor. And I would write a recipe completely differently for, you know, I have a couple of different columns for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age and Sunday Life magazine. And even though, like, I'd write a recipe differently if it's going out on a Sunday to how it would go out, say, in Good Food on a Tuesday. Mm. So it is, I guess there are so many different ways to cater for a different audience and cater for a different side of your own personality that I think you can, I guess, you can be all those things without it being disingenuous or artificial.
To me, that speaks to somebody who's very, very aware and very empathetic to what people are going through in their day-to-day lives. The fact that you're able to identify that what somebody's going to cook on a Sunday is very different to any other day of the week. What limitations do you find when you're putting yourself in the shoes of your audience or your readers? What are the barriers that you know the regular Aussie cook just will not be able to get over?
I don't know. I kind of feel like a velociraptor at times from the first Jurassic Park, where you're testing different parts of the fence to see what people are going to balk at. And it's stuff that there are things, you know, I don't have perfect insight into how people cook. Social media is brilliant in the sense that I do get feedback, some good, some bad, on what people are resonating with, what people are not resonating with. And that is such a useful, if you have a thick enough skin, being online is fabulous because you get to see other people's perspective reflected back or unsolicited at times as well on a range of issues that you would ordinarily not have insight into at all. You know, if you think about how a cooking show was made even 10 years ago, you know, someone had an idea, they did something, they broadcast it. And as soon as it got sent out into the ether, that was it. You know, you go start the next thing. You never got to see what, unless someone wrote a letter to the editor or something like that, you didn't see what anyone thought of it. You might have got some rating numbers, but you don't really have the insight into what was rating, why it was rating. You only have insight into what was rating. But these days, you know, down to that granular, like every single recipe level, I can see what people are thinking about and what people respond to. I think to answer your question, Tegan, people like, I guess, the idea of creativity when it comes to cooking, but they also like to feel comfortable. You know, there is a huge amount of, I think, there's a lack of confidence that people have in the kitchen because they always think that other people are eating better than them or that they're not a good cook or they can only do three things and everyone else can cook all these amazing things. Most people cook three things, you know, I'd probably cook three things, maybe a few more. But if you go through what people are having for dinner in their own families, people would generally think that their level of cooking, or they have a lot of insecurity around how well they're feeding their family. They want the idea of doing more, but they don't have they don't feel anyway that they have the time or they have the skill to be able to do that. So I like to write recipes that will make someone feel not just creative but comfortable at the same time as well.
It's really interesting. I'm thinking about my dad, who will go overseas and will refuse to attempt to speak any foreign language, not because he doesn't want to, but because he's afraid he'll look stupid if he fucks up the pronunciation of a word, right? Or I won't dance in public. I cannot dance. It's, well, I'm sure I could learn, but you mentioned before that you weren't Jewish, and we were talking about theology, and I think it's Taoism that posits the idea of mastery through repetition, right? And I was thinking about My Fair Lady and the idea that you could take some Cockney, like, chimney sweep or whatever, and in 2 weeks transform them, My Fair Lady style, into a competent chef, right? Do you think you... I mean, first of all, I don't think you think it's your job to educate. I think it's about, you know, it should be a joyous process. But do you think, with push came to shove, you could take anyone, right, under the right circumstances, if they were willing, and actually just get them that good?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Cooking is the easiest thing in the world. I think it was Thomas Keller from Per Se in California who says, you know, that the actual physical aspects of cooking is probably the easiest skill you could ever learn. Like, imagine trying to play the guitar, which I'm trying to do at the moment, is multitudes more difficult than picking up a knife and chopping something or putting something into a pan and then taking it out at another point. You know, there is nothing that is physically very difficult in cooking. So it is almost an entirely mental skill. And I think, you know, it's part art, part science. And I think most people don't understand the science cooking as well as they should. But then there's also this overlay of culture that goes over it. And people are very loath to challenge culture for better or worse. And so that's the impediments or the barriers that we put in place, are entirely self-inflicted when it comes to cooking. It's not like, I can chop really fast and therefore I'm a good cook. You know, you can make some of the guests that we've had on the show in terms of technical proficiency, not great cooks, but their food tastes amazing and constantly tastes amazing because they understand, I guess, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make the food taste good.
Yeah. So, but it's not like an oven gets hotter based on your physical strength or athletic prowess. It's not like how swole you are dictates how good a dish tastes.
Exactly.
I was going to say, you mentioned skating before, and I find that so interesting, and guitar playing, right? These are things that, I mean, technically speaking, you can just practice, right?
Yeah.
But there are some things people are naturally better at. So you don't think some people are naturally more... It's not like rhythm, right? Or, you know, there's people who will never be able to sing, right? Like there is a tone deafness. And I sometimes look at friends of mine who are like fussy eaters or whatever, and I think, you are never going to be good in the kitchen. Do you think that is a self-imposed kind of shortcoming? Like, do you think they could overcome those things?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I guess I don't know where cooking intuition comes from. I suspect it just comes from enjoying eating food. But I think if you're talking about people who are good cooks versus people who are not so good cooks, I think you'll find that they appreciate food very differently rather than grew up, you know, being exposed to it or whatever. You know, there are a lot of people who are fabulous cooks who just didn't grow up eating great food at all. But I think the appreciation of food is probably the strongest determiner of whether someone can cook well.
So it's not that you are born, you know, being exposed to 400 types of food. It's more that you just really like food and kind of want to try.
Well,
things.
I mean, look at you. You grew up in a household where the food was incredible, Paul. My mum's tuna mornay could, I mean, that was not something that would have fostered a love of food.
No, that could that could hold off an army. That stuff's it's a very sturdy dish. Yeah, but
it was a sturdy and unnecessary moment in my life.
But you're very adventurous. You
Thank
know.
You. Well, I really like eating. But just looking ahead again, Adam, at some of these new shows that you've got coming out, as you've said, you approach all of these things really differently. So for something like Good Food Kitchen, what can people expect for this show? How should viewers approach it?
The thing I like about... So I produced Good Food Kitchen as well as sort of being a part of it. And the way that we conceptualized it was trying to take people behind the process of putting together, you know, good food is, it's a magazine, it's a website, it's a weekly lift out in the newspaper. And there's a lot that goes into that, from, I guess, the recipe development through the actual cooking and the testing and down to the photography and styling. And so we do try and take people kind of behind the scenes of that. So it is, again, we try and do it as faithfully as possible. Obviously, it's still a TV show, so it's not exactly the way it happens. So I don't, there's no angry editors emailing me because I've missed deadline again or anything like that. But, you know, the photographer that we show in the show is the actual photographer that photographs all of my dishes for Good Food, and the stylist is the actual stylist who does all of that, and the recipes that we're cooking and the actual kind of ones that we would do for the show. So it was just this idea of giving people a little bit more than a cooking show. It's kind of Good Food is a trusted brand in, I guess, the Australian cooking landscape, and trying to get people to kind of have a look at how that comes together.
That's brilliant. I'm going to love the shit out of that one.
You kind of sound like you can't, I mean, we're sitting here kind of talking about all your accomplishments and, you know, when you eventually do learn everything about cooking and release your 50th show, Adam's Cooking Singularity, that's going to be great. But I'm just curious as to whether there's anything you can't do, because, I mean, have you...
To make you feel better?
No, I'm trying to... No, what I'm trying to do is, I think people do feel slightly like cooking can be a little bit inaccessible, and I think what helps humanize these you know, people who do this amazing stuff is finding out that they are just as fallible as you are. So I'm curious, Adam, as to whether you have ever truly screwed the pooch in the kitchen. I mean, what's your biggest mistake that you've ever made? Like high stakes stuff.
Yeah, it happens. You know, I remember my dad came home from the butcher's, and this is when tomahawk steaks were, you know, really having their moment in the sun. Not that they're not now. I still don't mind one, but, so tomahawk is basically a very large Scotch fillet, usually still attached to a long bone that gives it this kind of big tomahawk shape. So, he brought home this, you know, $200 steak, and he was the proudest it had ever been. And at that time, there was this thing called reverse sear that was kind of all the rage. And it was, well, it's not particularly new. It was the idea that you cook a piece of meat and then you sear it after. Rather than searing it before and cooking after. If you look at the history of cooking, actually, that's a very old style of cooking that only changed through the intervention of Escoffier and Eustace von Liebig, who invented the Liebig condenser. But I digress. my dad gave me this very expensive steak to cook, and I was like, oh, I'm going to do this fancy reverse sear technique, which involves, you know, cooking it in an oven first with a thermometer so you get the exact temperature, similar to sous vide, I guess, just without the vacuum, and then you sear it afterwards. And I don't know why, but I completely screwed it up, and this very expensive steak that my dad was looking forward to for the hours that it took to get ready was tough as a board.
No.
And completely well done all the way through, and I was distraught at it because I was similarly looking forward to it as well. But I guess when it comes to, you know, I try to tell my kids are big on the I can't do it kind of thing, and I'm not a tiger dad by any stretch of the imagination, but one philosophy that I've tried to live by myself is that I don't assume that I can't do something just because I've never done it before. You know, I'll give it a go, and so there are things, trust me, there are things that I'm not particularly good at. I'm not a very fast runner in a straight line anyway. You know, I'm pretty agile, but not in a straight line.
Right. Duck and weave. But, yeah, just duck and weave.
Yeah. But, you know, I truly don't think that you can say that you're not good at something unless you've given it a go and actually suck at it.
Yeah. But I think that's, you know, that's really clear in your career trajectory, in that you are the sort of person who, yeah, just gives things a go and seems to do terribly well at a lot of the things that you do try, but it is nice knowing that come the Olympics next, whatever it's going to be, Paris, that we will not see you there sprinting. That is one thing that we can go, Adam Lee, I will not be doing.
Well, now we've got breakdancing. You can give breakdancing a shot, right?
Or skateboarding.
Yeah, the 43-year-old me going up against a 13-year-old in the skateboarding, I'm sure.
Hey, man, a 39-year-old woman who started karate about a year and a half before the Olympics won gold this year.
Did she start a year and a half before the Olympics?
I think it was 2 years.
This is a Spanish woman?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because I've started karate, Adam, like really, I went in the deep end.
Wow.
And I'm 38 and I just went hard and I didn't think I could and I did it and it's great. But the point is, a 39-year-old woman who started 2 years ago won gold at the Olympics in karate. So you can just, you know, just, I guess what I'm saying is, get your goddamn skates on. Well, look, we're on this island now, and obviously part of the whole deal of coming to this island is that you have to bring a dish with you. You can bring your desert island dish. It's the only dish you can... Sorry, how would you phrase this premise?
Well, it's the only... It's just the show you've been doing for weeks on end, Paul. This is the one dish that you will eat for the rest of eternity. And as somebody who has such an extensive repertoire, I'm sure that this is a really, really difficult question for you. But, Adam, we've got to ask... What is your desert island dish?
Can I tell you that we had this as a theme on the Cook Up? I don't think the episode's gone to air yet.
Oh, crap.
And we had this same discussion about, you know, how do you define a desert island dish? Mm. And I said, don't define it. You know, just let people, you know, just say that the theme is desert island dish and we'll let our guests cook whatever it is that they think that is their desert island dish. And so we had Christina Arnoux on and she made cassava cake because she was born in the Torres Strait and there was a time where, and I don't know why I'm laughing at this, but they were cut off from, because of storms and things, they were cut off from.
It's not funny at all. Jesus.
No, it isn't. Cut off from deliveries from the mainland. And so for a number of months when she was a kid, all she had to eat was cassava. And so she made this cassava cake. It was delicious. You know, it certainly wasn't something that was, that spoke of, not being able to get ingredients because it was lovely. But she made that. We had the actor Remy He on as well, and he made like a cheese toastie with kimchi because he thought that his interpretation was that it was not going to be, there weren't going to be many ingredients, so he'd just do stuff that you'd have lying around, like kimchi and bread and cheese.
Right.
So yeah, it was really interesting to see how that was interpreted. So, I guess for me, my understanding of desert island dish is something that, you know, I would want to eat for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yes.
And so my view on that is Hainanese chicken rice. It's my favorite dish.
No way.
Yeah.
But this is wild. This is the first time we've had a double up on the island.
Oh, my God. Melissa Leong cooked her family Hainanese chicken rice, and that was her recipe. And
and now you guys are going to have to battle it out on the island. So Melissa Leong is also trapped here on our island with us. She was like our fourth person that we kidnapped.
She's been here for a while.
She's been here for a while.
She's gone full Tom Hanks. She's got a beard and a volleyball covered in blood. Right. It's pretty weird. Yeah.
And she also brought her recipe. So I would love to hear how you make your version of Hainanese chicken rice.
Well, it is a dish that's best shared. So I'm very happy to share it with the likes of Melissa, who is fabulous. The way that mine is made, I guess, changes a lot. So this is a dish that I've grown up with essentially from the beginning. You know, my grandfather is from Hainan. My grandmother has been making Hainanese chicken rice literally since I was born, well, from long before I was born. And so the two sides of my family, which are, I guess, Chinese and Chinese Malaysian and then sort of Singaporean, combine in this dish in many ways. Historically, so my grandfather is from a place in English that you'd call Little Bear Village, which is about 20 minutes away from an area called Wenchang, which is where the inspiration for Hainanese chicken rice came from. So there's a type of chicken called a Wenchang chicken that's fed on a specific dietary regime. It's kind of the Hainanese version of Wagyu, but for chicken. And so that's the origins of Hainanese chicken rice. And so on Hainan, Hainanese chicken rice doesn't exist, or it does now because they've kind of reappropriated it back into Hainanese cuisine. But it was this Wenchang chicken that was the origins of that. Just a very simple, good quality, extremely good quality chicken that's boiled. Usually it's a capon, so which is a young rooster that has been castrated. We obviously don't castrate chickens anymore in most countries. But when Hainanese chicken rice, when Wenchang chicken came to Malaysia, when Hainanese people came to Malaysia, it became this dish called Hainanese chicken rice, which is, I guess, poached chicken that then has the fat rendered from it, or usually the fat's rendered first. Poach the chicken, fry the rice in the fat from the chicken with some garlic and onion and things, and then cook the rice with the stock that you poached the chicken in. So it's, to me, it's this really kind of philosophical dish where you are making use of every aspect of it. You're creating something from very, very simple ingredients, you know, one chicken, couple of cups of rice, and some sauces and things to go on along the outside, that kind of makes the best use of ingredient. So when my family came from Hainan to the Straits region, part of them went, some of them went to Malaysia, some of them went to Singapore, and then I did a series in Singapore years later where I went to, so technically he's my cousin, but he's in his 70s, cousin because he was the same generation of the family, and he ran a Hainanese chicken rice stall for, you know, 50 years before he retired. And so my way of making it's kind of a blend of the way my grandma taught me to make it, the way my cousin made it, and then, you know, then I went back to my ancestral village in Hainan and made it there as well with the actual Wenchang chicken that is for another series I did on China. And so then I saw sort of differences in how they're doing it in Hainan, like in the Liao village. Like, it's called Little Bear Village, but 95% of the people that live there are my family.
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of a blend. I think probably if Melissa was making it, she'd be making hers a bit more Singaporean style, but mine's a bit more blended.
That's amazing. And I'm assuming then that when this episode of The Cook Up comes out, that we'll get to see you making this dish. Is that correct?
Nah.
I
did like a fish dish, like, because the other two guests were treating the theme as like what ingredients would you have on a desert island. I did like a fish and coconut dish that was actually inspired a little bit by Jimmy Barnes, who you should get on this island too, because you know, he made a fried fish that I thought was absolutely delicious. So I did this sort of coconut fish dish that just so that I didn't, you know, when you have guests that come into your kitchen, you don't want to say that they've got the theme wrong, you know. So if I'm doing my dish that I want to eat for the rest of my life, and you know, Remy's making a toasted cheese sandwich, and Christina's talking about the lean times when she was growing up on the Torres Strait and they were cut off from the mainland, I didn't want to kind of reinterpret the theme back to
Seaful,
how I wanted to.
You could learn about this, Adam. One of our guests, Sian Redgrave, who you may know, she was the winner of a Great Australian Bake Off the first season here. She brought a bag of flour because that was her interpretation of the desert island dish, because she could make so much from said bag of flour. And Paul, you shamed her. You shamed her so badly.
I flipped my shit because she basically broke the rules. She was like, I can cook, as a result, I can cook anything that involves flour. I'm like, no, that's not how it works. So everyone, I mean, Celia Pakwala wanted to bring an entire Australian small town bakery where she could get a salad roll. And we had to go, Seals, you need to just pick a thing from the bakery. But just imagine that this is like, you just every day wake up and this dish is there. I mean, with those parameters in mind, you're on an island, you're under a palm tree, you know, are you happy with this dish every day, Adam?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it just seems to be such a perfect dish for you because it just makes sense. And one of the things we've loved about watching you so much lately is that just you make sense and you say things that are so obvious. One of the points that you made on your show, The Cook Up, was just instead of buying separate pieces of chicken, just buy a chicken and cut it up. So obvious, and it just makes sense. And last night we were watching the show again and you taught us how to season a wok, which has been scaring me and has been intimidating me for years now. And it was like, oh, look, you made it easy. You just make things work in my head, and I'm just so appreciative that you welcome us into your kitchen again and again.
Oh, well, thank you. When you're seasoning your wok, don't put too much oil in. Every time people send me photos of their woks that they've seasoned, they've used too much oil. So really don't put too much oil in.
I'd like to see you combine the two things, and I'd like to cut to a proper half pipe down the road from us and see you seasoning the half pipe. Just, you know, those, just getting it ready for your Olympic bid.
Thank you so much. This is a, it's a really big deal in that I think two of our most expert foodies have both brought the same dish.
It's super, it's really weird. But it's also perfectly on point because you were talking about tradition and the fact that, you know, there's only so many dishes. The fact that two people on the same island have made the same dish in such different ways is, you know, it's really nice.
It is absolutely lovely.
It's an iconic dish for those of us who come from that part of the world. It's an iconic dish. But I actually would say if we made my version of Hainanese chicken rice and put it next to Melissa's, they would be quite different because there's a lot of different regional variations. Melissa being from Singapore, they tend to use a bit more sort of black sauce, as they would call it, on there as well. And there's many different variations for a dish that is really only sort of 100 years old.
Well, in the future, another television show where the same dish cooked by different people from slightly different regions, I would enjoy that one too. Unless you're already making that next month, I'm not sure.
That's a great idea, though. That would be a fascinating show. Anyway.
Well, it's been so lovely to talk with you. Thank you so, so much for your time. And we can't wait to just watch even more of your wonderful shows when they come out in the future.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
Thanks for having me on the desert island.
Well, that was a bloody treat, wasn't it?
He is so much more thoughtful and he's deep. He's so much deeper than I thought he was going to be. Not that he doesn't come across as very intelligent and deep on his show, but it's like, oh, I've actually got some stuff to really ponder and, you know, chew on now.
Yeah, he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi of food.
Yes, he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi of food.
He just rocks up, teaches you life lessons, and then waves his hand and disappears. He's amazing. And also I've seen him move kitchen implements with his mind, so there's that. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed the episode. We had such a great time talking with Adam and we've had such a great time talking with each other.
Clearly now we have to actually go off and try cooking Hainanese chicken rice. I think the fact that two of the leading food personalities in the country have both gone, that is the one thing I want to eat for the rest of time. I mean, that is crazy, Paul. This must be the best thing on earth.
I think given the trend, I think in about 5 or 6 episodes, we're going to have a future guest pitch like a third variation of Hainanese chicken rice. We're going to have to call this, we're going to have to rebrand this Hainanese chicken rice island in about 10 weeks.
Not another rebrand.
Oh my God.
Well, look, for now, we're going to give that recipe a go. Also, exciting news, my ice cream mixing bowl, my KitchenAid attachment arrived yesterday.
Yep.
The Darren is here now.
Oh, the Darren. I'm going to get it like a label put on the side. You know how you get B-52 bombers during the war had like a sexy lady and a name on the side.
Yes.
We'll get that done. But it's going to be Darren Hayes in a beautiful one piece kind of saluting or something.
Oh, that would be amazing. We're also going to hopefully start making our own ice cream soon. Mm. We'll report back in and let you know how we go. But for now, thanks for being here and for listening to another episode. We just really appreciate you tuning in each week. We have changed the brand, but
it's the same taste you've grown accustomed to. So thanks for listening to Dish Island.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Dish Island.
Dish Island is a proud member of the Acast Creator Network.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.